Chapter 8. The Station Chief. It's a tribute to the CIA's cult of secrecy that by the time Charlie Wilson met Howard Hart in November 1982, he had never, to his knowledge, talked to an active member of the CIA's clandestine services. He was on the subcommittee that appropriated the agency's money, but he had no understanding of what the CIA really did or how its officers operated. Howard Hart wasn't happy about briefing the congressman. The cable from headquarters had arrived in the crammed CIA station with this simple directive: the Honorable Charles Wilson, Democratic representative from Texas, arriving Islamabad. As member of Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, he is entitled to full classified briefing on the Afghan war. The station chief figured there was almost nothing positive that could come from this meeting. But Wilson was on a committee the CIA couldn't afford to alienate, and Hart, ever the disciplined secret soldier, set out to do his duty. Any case officer must have a capacity to charm and manipulate, and Howard Hart made sure to put on his most charming self when he greeted the congressman downstairs in the temporary U.S. Embassy. Ever since a mob of Muslim fanatics had burned down the new $22 million embassy to the ground 3 years earlier, life in the temporary mission had been a claustrophobic nightmare. Hart's team was unusually small, given the scope of its mission in Pakistan. Only 25 people, including secretaries and technical workers, to keep the Afghan war going and to spy on the Pakistanis and their nuclear program. And all he could get for them was 3 windowless rooms on the 5th floor, so crowded that his agents had to take turns using the few desks and telephones. The CIA, as a practice, locates its stations abroad in U.S. embassies. In Islamabad, Hart operated under the cover of being the first political secretary, the same job that Dick Welch, the Athens station chief, had held when he was gunned down outside his home several years before. Hart's operation was officially known as the Regional Affairs Office. He and his fellow officers were located on the 5th floor in what amounted to a vault with a combination lock on the door. This was all very new to Wilson, who felt a bit like a kid when he realized he was about to enter his first CIA station. But he carefully took stock of Howard Hart. The congressman's only prior exposure to the CIA had been through the renegade operative Ed Wilson, now beginning his 52-year sentence in a federal penitentiary. Ed Wilson had lectured him on how the agency had been deballed, as he put it, and taken over by careerists interested only in playing it safe. The congressman still had his suspicions about the agency, but the one thing he did know for certain when he walked through the embassy with the handsome blonde 42-year-old American was that Howard Hart was the real McCoy. To Wilson, he seemed almost to be stepping out of a movie. The congressman thought he looked a bit like Nick Nolte, his voice eerily like William Holden's. Beyond that, Hart had the kind of command presence that an old Navy man like Wilson always found deeply impressive. For his part, the station chief was choreographing this experience for the congressman. He knew how the mumbo-jumbo awed outsiders, and so he was playing his part to the hilt. He effortlessly punched the code into the combination lock and let the congressman into his secret room. Motioning for Wilson to sit down, Hart busied himself with a briefcase which opened to disclose a row of dials. When he finished adjusting them, the sound of the 1812 overture filled the room, a standard agency technique to counter bugging. Not wanting to appear the amateur, Wilson did his best to look utterly accustomed to the ritual. Hart pulled out satellite pictures and pointed to the map, prepared to give the congressman one of his tour de force performances. He had already heard from his sources that Wilson was carping about the level of CIA support. It was too bad he couldn't tell this blowhard with the pretty boy hairdo and the cowboy boots how he had single-handedly escalated a set of village rebellions into an ongoing national war. But that would require confiding in a loose cannon about the way things work in the Directorate of Operations, and that was an inner sanctum that Howard Hart was not going to permit Charlie Wilson or any other congressman to enter. The small, intense world from which Howard Hart came was Archie Roosevelt's old club, the same fraternity within a fraternity that had inducted Gust Avrakatos in 1962 and Hart 4 years later. Hart was so proud of his place within this elite that he would always say he had not joined the CIA, but the clandestine services of the United States of America. Later in his career, when he was asked to talk to new recruits, That was always the message he would begin with. You are not joining the CIA. You are joining America's clandestine services. There are fewer case officers operating abroad than there are meter maids in New York. You are America's spies. You were selected because you are the most gifted young men and women of your generation, but all we can promise you is that after training, we'll send you to some terrible place, and when you finish your tour there, we'll send you to some other terrible place. And then the worst fate of all is that we'll make you come back to Washington for a year every once in a while, where you will have to live with the bureaucracy. And if you do anything good, you can't tell anyone about it. Other than that, it's a wonderful life. The point Howard Hart was making to each class of new recruits was that they were joining a priesthood, and no one should apply or begin to serve if he didn't feel the sense of mission. It could not be for the money or fame. It had to be for love of country. Howard Phillips Hart had been a small boy when he first experienced the wonder of being an American. His father was a banker in the Philippines in 1941 when the Japanese occupied the country and put all foreigners in prisoner of war camps. There were about 300 Americans, British, and Canadians living in the camp where Hart and his family were held captive. It wasn't such a bad life for a small boy who hadn't known anything different. There was just enough to eat and good fellowship, and the adults had time to spend with the children. But it got suddenly menacing when General MacArthur fulfilled his promise and began the liberation of the Philippines. Around Christmas time in 1944, as the U.S. forces moved into Manila, word spread through the camp that all of the prisoners were to be murdered. Over the next 2 weeks, American forces captured 20,000 of the 400,000 Japanese occupying the Philippines. The rest fought to the bitter end or committed suicide. But the Americans had yet to free the camp prisoners. One blood-red morning in January 1945, on a day the Japanese were preparing to execute their charges, the young boy looked up and saw the sky filled with parachutes. As gunfire filled the camp, Hart's mother told her son that the American soldiers were coming to rescue them. 300 paratroopers began landing all around. Suddenly, the small boy was in the arms of a large American GI. As shells exploded around them, everyone ran to the water's edge, where the U.S. Navy had sent a flotilla of Amtraks to ferry the prisoners to safety across the lake. The 4-year-old boy was impressed with the explosions, but the memory that would stay with him was of the GI carrying him to freedom. After the war, Hart's father resumed his life as a banker in the Philippines. At night, when family friends would gather, they'd always end up talking about their wartime experiences organizing guerrilla forces to battle the Japanese. Hart stood in awe of these Americans who had risked their lives to fight for freedom. These late-night talks became a kind of ongoing seminar for the boy, who listened and stored away their wisdom on guerrilla tactics and strategy. When his turn came in Afghanistan, he would draw from those lessons and push that advice on the Mujahideen. Never try to take and hold territory. Hit and run. Don't use radios to communicate. The enemy will intercept your messages and find you. Don't build base camps that need to be defended. Stay light and mobile. Hart was like most Americans brought up abroad after World War II. He considered the United States to be the all-powerful beacon of freedom, and being an American in the Third World felt special. When he became old enough, his father sent him off for polishing to Kent, a boarding school in Connecticut for young men, and then on to college at Colgate. But midway through Hart's college career, his father went bankrupt, and he was forced to drop out. A friend told him that if he moved to Arizona, he could enroll at the University of Arizona for free. A surprising number of gifted academics were clustered at the University of Arizona, where Hart went on to receive a graduate degree in Oriental Studies, specializing in South Asia and learning Urdu. His decision to pursue a career in the service of his country came to him all at once on a cold January day in 1961, listening to John Kennedy's inaugural address. "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." Just as it did for Gustav Rakatos and Charlie Wilson, both of whom were listening at the very same time, the words had an explosive impact on the young man. With the memory of the huge GI who had come out of the sky to carry him to freedom and the words of President Kennedy, Hart felt he had no choice but to serve his country, and he decided then and there that, if they would have him, he would join the CIA.